So we have on the line Nick Rosen, who's the editor of off-grid.net, and he's also the author of two books on living off the grid. One's a UK edition that's been out for a couple of years called How to Live Off-Grid, and the brand new one is called Off the Grid, and it's a completely new version of the book. And Nick joins us from the UK. Nick, welcome.
Hi there.
Hi. So, okay, so first off, let's just define our terms for anyone. What does off the grid mean?
Well, literally, it means living without mains utilities, without electric power from a utility company, without water from the utility company, without gas, and also without sewage, you know, and waste disposal. So it means running all of those things yourself. It doesn't mean living without electricity. It simply means that you're providing your own. So that's the literal meaning. And then there's a more metaphorical meaning, which is about stepping outside the system to a greater or lesser extent. So some of the people I write about in the book have got no ID cards of any sort and just do not take part in conventional society. Others have got mainstream jobs, just happen to live off-grid. One is a county commissioner in Colorado, and her husband works at the local airport, but they've just chosen, the house they've chosen was off the grid, and as a result was $150,000 cheaper than the same house would have been on the grid. That which is a differential, I think, is going to disappear, in fact, because I think pretty soon people are going to cotton on to the fact that it's pretty comfortable living off the grid these days. The technology has come a long way since the back to the land movement of the 70s.
Now, it's interesting. How did you write the U.S. edition? How did you research it?
Oh, I got on the road and I went around and I visited people, and one person led to another, and you know, somebody suggested I should go to, you know, eco community in North Carolina, so I'd go down there, and then they'd send me on to somebody else. So that's how I did it. It was pretty hard work because, if I wanted to spend a couple of years on the job, I could have had a very pleasant time. But I wanted to really make it a snapshot of the off-grid America, you know, at the moment. And to do that, I had to shift around the states pretty fast. So I spent about a month in Northern California and few weeks in Florida, Texas, New York State, which is very, very big for off-grid, and then went to another half a dozen states, Kentucky, and well, I'm running out now, but I've forgotten, but a few other states.
Now, did you do a similar process for the UK version, where you went around and spoke to people, or?
Well, the UK version was much easier because Britain is roughly the size of Kansas.
Right.
And the off-grid community is much more available there, or it was to me at the time, I guess, being part of it made it easier. So in Britain, I was able to just get into my camper van, as we call them over here, RV, a converted white hospital bus with my wife and kid, and truck around Britain and had a lovely time, and it was very leisurely and pleasant. But the distances are tiny. I mean, you can go end to end in a day and a half. And so this was a very different thing, researching the American one. And also the American off-grid population is far more diverse. The British off-grid population basically is environmentalists and a few Rhodes protesters. But in America, it's a much, much more burgeoning culture with survivalists, environmentalists, people who've been foreclosed. You know, people are doing it for ideological reasons. People are doing it purely for reasons of finance or the lack of it.
Well, and like you said, there's also there's a big political difference between a survivalist and an environmentalist in the U.S. One's going to be over to the far right side of the spectrum. The other's going to be over to the far left side. But they both are sort of both have the off-the-grid thing in common.
Well, they agree on one thing, at least, which is peak oil. I mean, I think that's one subject that unites those two groups, is a feeling that oil is never going to be cheaper than it is now. It's just going to go rising in price. And that anything which America can do to reduce its dependency on oil, including having large numbers of people living off the grid, is a good thing. But yeah, they're on opposite sides of the spectrum. They're doing it for different reasons, but they're using the same technologies, and the movement is growing fast, which is good for everyone, because the skills that are needed to live off-grid are quite diverse, and there's not many people who've got those skills all in one person. I admire the people who can just do it all on their own. But what's needed is to get those skills out there, you know, wiring and solar and plumbing, but all off-grid wiring and plumbing. That's quite a skill set.
Now, I'm also interested how you got involved personally. Now, first off, are you living off the grid yourself, or...?
Part-time. Sometimes I live off the grid for 6 months at a time, but I got interested in it because for two reasons, really. One is there was a beautiful place in Spain that I wanted to have a holiday home there, and I couldn't afford it. It was way out of my price range at the time, and I thought either I could wait till I was old and rich and had the money, or I could do what I did, which was buy a shepherd's hut up in the mountains for £7,000, about $10,000, and kind of shortcut the system. So I bought the shepherd's hut, and I thought it was going to be pretty uncomfortable, but it wasn't. It was pretty comfortable. I didn't use it much the first few years. That was about 15 years ago. And then in 2003, I happened to be in New York for the big East Coast power outage. And that really got me thinking about the grid and what it was and who controlled it. And so on the one hand, I had this place that made me realize I didn't need the grid. And on the other hand, I was there witnessing the kind of devastation that took place when it was suddenly withdrawn, and watching and listening to the explanations from the electricity industry, and realized that actually this invisible grid that we take for granted has got a lot of negatives. I mean, it's an amazing achievement in a way, but it's got a lot of things wrong with it. And if it didn't exist, I don't think we'd need to invent it.
That's interesting. Now, how did and when did you start the website was that when you made the decision to write the first book as well?
No, it didn't sort of come as a blinding flash or anything. It kind of slowly dawned on me over the next couple of years that this was really. But there was something to this issue of off the grid, that putting that in the same way that you know, that book The Omnivore's Dilemma kind of tackles the subject of big food. Well, nobody has really tackled the subject of big power. I mean, we know that energy is sort of, you know, polluting and inefficient, but nobody's really had a look at the electricity industry and said, well, who are they exactly? What are they doing? What are they up to? And so I've kind of got interested in that, and at the same time was continuing my off-grid existence part-time, and then in about 2005 started the website, and gradually built it up from there, and then wrote the British book a couple of years later, and wrote this book, which has just come out last year. And it really was interesting researching the history of the grid in America and the way that the electricity industry is structured now, and realizing that the huge inefficiencies which are built into the grid, the way that half the power is lost right there at the power station where they make the electricity, another 30% is lost as it comes, you know, down into your home, and more is lost in the home in the inefficiencies of the appliances. And it all goes back to Thomas Edison in Manhattan when he first started selling light to the wealthy people of Manhattan. After a few years or less, he changed his business model, and instead of charging per light or per room, he started metering the power. And from that moment, there was no incentive for energy efficiency, quite the opposite. The utility companies from the earliest days have had every incentive to make sure that we consume as much energy as possible. And of course, they were the ones selling us the light bulbs and all the appliances. And they made huge secretive alliances across America in order to sell us more stuff and gadgets, and ran very, very effective advertising campaigns. Of course, they were pushing on an open door. People wanted these things, especially light. Everybody wanted electricity. But it didn't have to be this way. It didn't have to be the system where there's a small number, a very large power stations, and with sending the electricity around the country, we could have tiny power stations at the end of every street. It just happened to work out this way.
Now, it's interesting. Let's talk about a couple specific issues that people deal with. I've been to the UK enough to know that there's a different view of air conditioning in the United States and Europe. I've been at hotels in Britain where I called down and was trying to figure out where the air conditioning was, and they just sort of laughed at me because the air conditioning was open a window. How do people who are living off-grid, do they have air conditioning? I live in New Mexico where it would be tricky without AC.
Well, I visited a very large number of off-grid places in New Mexico. It was one of the biggest off-grid communities in the country, probably. And they don't have AC. And they could have. I mean, it would be possible if you kind of kept it into one room, and quite a small room at that.
Right.
It would be quite easy to have good quality air conditioning in one room in an off-grid house without draining your entire reserves. Because you can have everything that in a normal American household does have. You can have your fridge and your washing machine and your dishwasher and all your appliances. You just cannot run them all at the same time. And you end up, when you're living off the grid, you end up being quite strategic. You sort of plan to switch your washing machine on at 2 a.m. just before you go to bed or something, when nothing else is on. And, you'll do it on a day when there's been lots of sun, so your batteries are all charged up. So, And a lot of people who live that way rather like that. They like the fact that they're brought more closely into contact with the forces of nature. They don't, you're running your own power station. The benefit is you don't pay the utility company anything. The cost is that you have to spend a bit of time as the power station manager. But when it comes to air conditioning, of course, New Mexico's got a fine tradition of Pueblo Indian architecture. They didn't have air conditioning. They just made sure their windows were in the right place to create cooling breezes through the house at the right time of day. But a lot of those skills and knowledge has been lost. But it's very much to do with how you situate your house, where you put it, which direction it faces, and where the windows are. As well as, of course, having a cellar, which keeps you a lot cooler, having a root cellar for the food. So there's time-honored ways of dealing with these problems. Air conditioning is yet another wasteful use of electricity.
And the other thing I'd be interested in is how people that you've interviewed deal with the internet. Do they have it? Is that something that?
Absolutely, and I couldn't live without it. So I mean, I'm talking to you now off grid, as it happens, in my camper van. I've got a solar panel on the roof. And I plug the computer into the cigarette lighter connected to the spare battery, and power it that way. It goes through an inverter first and then into the cigarette lighter. And then I connect a wireless broadband thing from Verizon or Vodafone, it's called over here. And I've got very good broadband, no problem at all. When I visited people all over America, they were off-grid with the internet. I think most of them found that the best service was a satellite internet service for Blue something, I can't remember what now. It was about $60 a month for good quality satellite internet, which of course is better on the downloads than on the uploads. Other than that, of course, there's cyber cafes and phones these days have got very good internet. So yeah, everybody had internet. I call it being off the grid and on the cloud. And of course, you're still dependent on the grid. This isn't like some game. The book is not a sort of game about, I went off grid for 6 months, let's see how long I can survive without, the modern conveniences. This is a more serious issue than that. It's about a very large number of people, well over 1 million people now in America, who've chosen this lifestyle for a number of very good reasons. And it's not a game that you're not, it's not like a, a test to see whether you can do it, like some sort of bushcraft survival course. And likewise with solar panels, you know, if your solar panels run out, that's fine. You just turn on the generator that you've got standing by, $1,000, and of course that uses gas. But yeah, getting back to the internet, I met people living in a trailer in Big Bend, Texas, who were making a living on the internet, writing articles, you know, X number of cents per word. So it works fine out there.
Now, you talked about community, and one of the other issues I think that it would seem like you'd have is just sort of finding the land, is sort of finding a place to live. But you have something on the off-grid.net site now that sort of alleviates that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, land is a huge subject, of course, and finding the right piece of land is a huge subject in itself that I could go on about for ages, that should have water of some sort, preferably south-facing, have a bit of woodland with it because you're going to need trees for fuel and possibly building. And, you know, and which part of the country you should be in also depends on the kind of person you are and the kind of regulations you can live with. But yeah, we've started this free service on off-grid called Land Buddy, where anybody can go on and just make a mark on a Google map where they would like to go off-grid, ideally. And they can browse the map and see who else is in their area, in their chosen area. And people put up details about themselves and photographs. And so far, it's only been going a couple of months, but there's already hundreds of people on it. And so far, it's mainly people who want to go off the grid and who are looking for other people to go off the grid with, you know, so they can pool resources. And of course, the bigger a piece of land you buy, the cheaper it is per acre. And pool skills as well. You know, like I was saying, you know, the plumber and the electrician are probably going to need a lawyer to help them deal with the unhelpful officials that they're going to come across and so on. So becoming part of an off-grid community, by which I do not mean a commune, I just mean a community of like-minded souls who will live in the same area, is the most successful way to go off the grid. And we're trying to foster that as much as possible, because although there are many people who live off-grid and many millions of people who have thought about it and are considering doing so, they're quite widely scattered, and you wouldn't just bump into one at the bar without knowing it.
Now, you mentioned regulations and stuff like that. From the research you've done, what are the best and the worst places in the United States to consider doing this?
Well, in a way, some of the best and worst places are the same places, because Northern California is one of the best places because it's got great land, very good climate, but of course it's got very expensive land, and a lot of the existing residents would kind of oppose the idea of a bunch of new residents turning up. So there's that problem. So the places that you'd want to live are the most difficult places to get off the grid. But North Carolina was less troublesome and has got a lot of the benefits. It's very beautiful. It's good, got good quality arable land, a lot of woodland. So I'd say North Carolina around Asheville would be a good place to look. And then again, it depends on your budget. You'd probably be paying $30,000-$40,000 just for the land in that area, whereas in Big Bend, Texas, which is pretty arid desert, people were paying $5,000 for 50 acres with some water on it somewhere, you know, somewhere you'd have to dig a well. And in Taos, outside Taos, New Mexico, people were paying just a few hundred dollars for land, although it was land that had kind of last been sold during the World's Fair in 1921, you know, and had a very dubious title. But if you're only building a $2,000 home on it, then that matters less, perhaps.
And what kind, now you talk about a $2,000 home, are people doing that?
Sure. You know, depends on your budget. Anything from $2,000 to $100,000. But I'd say as a rule of thumb, $75,000 ought to be able to get you a decent little patch of land where you can build and grow some food and have a few chickens. $75,000 should get you the land and the building and a basic energy system for a modest, you know, one or two bed home, but comfortable. And of course, when you're off grid, small is beautiful, because the bigger your home, the more you've got to, the more time and energy you've got to devote to heating it and cooling it and maintaining it. So people tend not to overhouse themselves off the grid.
Now, what does the new book is Off the Grid, the U.S. edition's just out, right?
Yeah.
And so what is the book, does the book sort of take you through all the stuff you'd need to know to get started at this?
It does, but fairly subtly. It's not a how-to. You know, all of that kind of how-to information is available on the website. The book is very much more about why people are going off-grid, why you might decide to go off-grid. It does, in passing, mention kind of arrangements that the characters in the book have made. You know, there's one guy in there who's a writer and a surfer, and he had gone off-grid because he'd lost faith in the government. He just didn't believe the story about 9/11. He believed that it was a kind of conspiracy theory. Alan Weisbecker, he's called. He's quite a well-known author. He wrote a book called In Search of Captain Zero. And I came across him living in a beach in Mexico. He'd driven down from New York State, Montauk, where he lived. And so he was living on a beach because he didn't trust the system anymore. He thinks it's about to collapse. And in amongst that, I mention his living arrangements. He's managed to rent himself a little convenient stretch of beach. It's right next to a restaurant, which has wireless broadband. And he's put up a kind of tent, which is his office. And he's got his car and his trailer that he drove down in, which form part of his household now. I think he uses the trailer as a kind of fridge and kitchen. So he's got a great setup on the beach. And, you know, and he says when what they say in survival land is, I can't remember the an acronym now, but WTS, whatever, when the S hits the fan, he will be ready with his fish and coconuts and his setup there. So I talk about people's precise arrangements, but not in great detail, because, first of all, that kind of technology is still changing so fast. It's like the internet 15 years ago. We're really just at the starter slopes of it all. And solar technology is, and fuel cells and other such things are really going to take off over the next few years. So it's more about the reasons people have, whether it's financial or ideological.
And sort of at the other end of the spectrum, do you find people who are? How did it break down? Was there the survivalist? Was that a bigger percentage than the people who were just wanting a different? Wanting to cut cost or be independent?
Well, of course, the people who wanted to cut cost and be independent, they obviously had a predisposition towards that. I mean, they considered it a real possibility. They didn't consider they were kind of going back to the Stone Age just because they had a composting toilet.
Right.
And so, but I think the number one reason for being off the grid would be financial. But within that, it would be people who felt good about saving energy and helping the environment. So, but that financial reason varied from individual to individual. So like I said, there's a family who bought a home for $200,000 that would have cost them $350,000 had it been on the grid. And then there was the lady in Big Bend, Texas, who had her home foreclosed in New York State. And driven down with her three kids, bought this land, I think, probably on eBay, and just moved in with a couple of trailers and was working in the local bar. So even within a specific category like financial, there were a wide variety of different kinds of people. But all of them wanted one thing. They wanted more control over their own lives. They wanted to live the way they believed was the right way to live, and that united them as much as the technology united them.
Well, yeah, no, it's all very, very interesting. And the website is great. And if people are interested, they need to go to the website. It's very well organized, and you've got a tremendous amount of information there. So good job on that. And people can get the book everywhere, Amazon and so on.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble and Borders and all of those places, yeah.
Okay, that's great. Nick, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good to talk to you.